that estimated cost is about $400,000 per year as a result of interactions with income tax and with the PTR program. That is because I guess there was an assumption that under the bill passed in July, we would have had levy restrictions that would have been reducing the levies of cities and counties and other taxing entities. Now we're saying that they would be able to levy a little bit more. So there is a small fiscal note that goes along with this that was prepared by the Department of Revenue. I don't know that any assumed savings was anticipated when the tax bill was passed last year, but that's another issue. But you should be aware that in the out biennium there is a small cost. Again, I think this bill will anticipate any future class rate changes or exclusions that the legislature, this legislature, or future legislatures may anticipate or consider. And so we think that this really will clean up the statutes in a very comprehensive manner. With that, Madam Chair, I guess we would stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Are there questions of any of the witnesses? Representative Macheski?
I have a technical question. The eminent domain change, the Section 15, Mr. Madam Chair, and maybe it's for maybe Gary Carlson. So I'm just trying to think through if the structurally substandard blight test and you're trying to redefine it, is that one seems like it's not as clear cut in what you're testifying to. Can you just talk about that a little bit?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, if it pleases the committee, I'll take the answer. A few years ago, a number of changes were made in the eminent domain statute, and one of those was addressing the use of eminent domain for economic development purposes. And basically, the statute that's amended here, 117.025, subdivision 7, was basically meant to put some restrictions on the use of eminent domain for economic development purposes. And so it basically defines the criteria by which the determination is made whether or not the property is structurally substandard and thus whether or not eminent domain can be used to acquire properties to address the blighted condition that the community thinks exists. If you do not change this provision, basically the threshold that the city or possibly the county has to get over is lower. By referencing estimated market value, you're setting a higher bar, and we believe that is consistent with the original statute as it was enacted a few years ago.
Mr. Linuchesky.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and just if we could just briefly have a little explanation on what's going on in watershed districts. I know there's, I think, five different sections on watershed districts.
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, you're correct. There are a number of sections, and this is one example of where tax rate limitations apply to, in this instance, watershed districts, and there are also a few that apply to what are called watershed management organizations, which may exercise basically the same function here within the seven-county metropolitan area. They have explicit authorities for certain functions or programs right now. And depending on the district and how much low-valued homes they have in their jurisdiction, if you do not do this amendment, they will lose some of their taxing authority. Both Gary and I neglected to identify the range of effects of the homestead exclusion and what happens if you don't address this. For some entities, the effect is very, very small. In fact, for some, like the St. Paul Airport or the Met Airport, there's no effect whatsoever because there's no homesteads located within their taxing jurisdiction. But for some entities, we did an exercise where we identified the effect on cities. Some cities lose as much as 30% of their tax base. Consequently, to the effect that they're subject to these tax rate limitations or net debt limitations, they will have realized, absent enactment of this bill, a loss of taxing authority, a loss of debt a debt issuance authority in that 30% neighborhood. I did go through the watershed districts, or Mr. Hines did do it, and we found, you know, there was one district that was in the double digits. Most of them are in the single digits as to how much tax base they lost. But again, if you fail to enact this bill, they will have lost some authority for which their current programming is meant to address.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Mr. Carlson Keith, you had said at the end of your testimony that passing this bill will maintain the status quo. And, you know, as you know, property taxes went up about $370 million this year. Big part of it was the elimination of the homestead credit, which is why we're here today. I mean, what did you mean exactly by the status quo? And was the change from last year a lot different than status quo? I mean, I guess elaborate on that a little bit, on what you meant there.
Mr. Chairman, or Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, as I went through the 1988 changes, as I indicated, the whole intent, or half of the intent by the reference to market value, was meant that future changes in the tax base for administering the property tax or determining an individual properties was not meant to have an effect on the tax rate limitations or the net debt limitations. And again, as I gave you an example, in 2002, when the tax base shrunk substantially because of the rate reduction for class rate reduction for commercial industrial, there was no loss of tax rate taxing authority. There was no loss of debt authority for any affected jurisdiction that are affected by all the statutes cited here. Unfortunately, the statute based on the current Department of Revenue interpretation did not anticipate the effect of an exclusion. The law also ignores the disabled veterans exclusion, the this old moldy house exclusion, the this old business exclusion, the platted land exclusion, the list that Mr. Hines, and it's the law is just simply being updated. So for the sole purpose of determining tax rate authorities or debt authorities, those will stay the same as before the enactment of the 2011 changes with regards to the homestead credit and homestead exclusion.
Madam Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much. Say, Madam Chair, when Mr. Keith and Gary Carlson are completed with their testimony, could we have someone from Revenue come down and explain the revenue estimate? Either I see Mr. Ouellette or Ms. Von Mosch or someone.
Certainly.
Okay, thank you.
We can do that. Mm-hmm. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I was wondering if Mr. Carlson can just address Section 17, which deals with historical monies and allows cities to tax a small portion for historical reasons. If you could just address that particular issue, and I may have a question when you're done.
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, members, this is actually a cap on the amount of money that a city or town may appropriate for assistance to the Historical Society, and that cap is expressed in terms of a rate, in this instance, 0.02418% of taxable market value. Again, the intent here is basically to preserve the authority that they have right now. They have this authority for 2012. If you don't enact this bill and enact this section, their authority to appropriate for the Historical Society will shrink in most instances a little bit, and the value, as we said, ranges from less than a percent to up to 30%, depending on which community we're talking about.
Representative McDonald.
Madam Chairman, thank you. Just a question then for you, Mr. Carlson. If cities take advantage of this and do levy that each year, then they'll probably have a fund that it accumulates based upon any project they have to have approval by the Minnesota Historical Society. What happens if their projects aren't approved? Does that fund just continue to accumulate for the cities to use for historical reasons?
Mr. Carlson?
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, I don't, some cities or towns may do this on an annual basis, but I think much more of the common practice is somewhat on a one-time basis. But to the extent it was going to a specific project, say improving the local historical society museum or updating its archives, they're going to fall short of meeting that obligation if they happen to be at the far end of the spectrum where they lost 30% of their capacity.
Representative McDonald.
Madam Chairman, thank you. And then in closing, would cities be able to access this fund for the preservation of historical buildings in the community?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, the money goes to the Historical Society. To the extent the Historical Society isn't is engaged in the preservation of a historical building, yes, it could affect them.
Okay. Madam Chairman.
Representative Loeffler, were you?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. Follow up. So, Mr. Carlson, you said that the monies actually go to the County Historical Society. Is that correct?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, that's correct. It's possible that the State Historical Society may be participating in a specific project, too. I mean, it depends on what we're talking about here. But this is money from the city or town to the County Historical Society.
Okay. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I understand the intent of the bill to just deal with that, the changing definition on market value, but I noted on Section 36, then I went on the summary and found out it actually deals with fiscal disparities, but it's range fiscal disparities, in which there's a lot of deletion of responsibilities of the Commissioner of Revenue in reporting and calculating things, and you know, maybe part of the reason why the Metro fiscal disparities didn't get looked at for 40 years was because it wasn't being done by the Department of Revenue, and this one seems to take away a bunch of annual responsibilities, and I don't see where they're put assigned to someone else. Could you explain what that is?
Mr. Carlson?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, probably between your staffs, the Department of Revenue staff, and ourselves, the fiscal disparity statute was probably one of the areas where we spent the greatest amount of time. And quite frankly, upon review, we reviewed this with the administrative auditor here in the metropolitan area. We found that there were a lot of statutes that have never been administered or given effect during the entire duration of the program. And so as we went through the statutes, updating the references where appropriate to whatever is the appropriate market value criteria, we also deleted those that just simply have never been administered. And so in Section 36, the stricken language is basically something that's never been administered or is redundant, caught up in another portion of the statute.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, Madam Chair, and it may be that we'd all agree that those are things we don't care that they didn't do, but it seems to me that it's probably wise to have more than just the administering agencies say, well, we've never done this, so let's just clear it off the books and incorporate it into a bill that's really focused on other things. Because, you know, it seems like somebody should be responsible for doing these things, and that's where I was looking to see if it had been assigned to someone else.
Representative Loeffler, I think we do have a comment from Mr. Hines to that point.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I just wanted to point out that a lot of the, like in Section 36, a lot of what's being stricken is really because the terminology is made more uniform, really in Section 16 of the bill. It's right now there's a section 16, which is a statute in the school finance chapter of statutes. It defines how you compute this concept called adjusted net tax capacity, how you kind of bring sales ratios into the equation. And a lot of times in statutes we reference how it's done for schools, saying we want counties to do it the same way for counties that you do for schools, and we reference a statute that's in the school aid section. So part of what we did in the process that the Carlsons are describing as we looked through everything was we said, well, let's make the definitions more uniform. And we brought in on that statute that it also covers counties, cities, and towns. And then at the very end of the bill, we actually instruct the reviser to move that section from the school aid section into the property tax section so that all the references to adjusted net tax capacity, or in this case, adjusted market value, some concept of the sales ratio adjustment to tax base, are done in a property tax part of the statute. So I think it, I would have described it as more that's what we're striking, is the specific references in this, in the fiscal disparities, to a more general way of and uniform way of addressing those things. But there are some other things that represent, or that Mr. Carlson observed, that we weren't completely following, but those are more minor details.
Well, Senator Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. I mean, I see that the statute even originally referred to 127A48, which is that school provision. It's just I was looking at the responsibilities of the Commissioner of Revenue to calculate things and report things that I didn't see had been assigned anywhere else, nor do I see them in the school one. So I was wondering, is it in the school one somewhere?
Mr. Hines.
Yeah, Madam Chair, of Loeffler, right at the first sentence of that section 16 is the Department of Revenue must annually conduct an assessment sales ratio study. So it is still all very much within the purview of the Department of Revenue to do that, blood that work.
All right, thank you.
Any other
Madam Chair, if I could just also
Mr. Carlson.
To Representative Loeffler, there is a commensurate change in the metropolitan area fiscal disparity statute. I think it's in Section 94 as well. So we tried to make all of those uniform between both the Metro and the Iron Range fiscal disparities programs.
Thank you. Is there someone from the department that would like to come and testify or make comments? Mr. Ouellette, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Eric Ouellette with the Department of Revenue, and I can speak to the revenue estimate that Representative Marquardt brought up earlier. When we prepare a revenue estimate to consider a law change, we do have to measure what the bill does compared to what the department's understanding of current law is. So what we're really doing here is we're comparing what the levy authority would be under this bill to what it will be next year if you pass no legislation. And as Mr. Carlson explained, our interpretation is that those for levy limit purposes, market values would be lower because of the exclusion that would reduce the levy authority for a number of taxing jurisdictions. So what we did to prepare this estimate was to try to estimate what the difference in the levy limits would be under that smaller market value where the exclusion reduces the levy limit versus under this bill where we get closer to where the old law levy limits were. And then we compared those levy limits to what those jurisdictions are actually levying, and there were some jurisdictions for whom what they levied last year would exceed what their new levy limit would be if you allowed these levies to get lower by not passing this legislation. So we estimated that don't have perfect data on this, but we estimate that approximately $4 million of what they're currently levying, those some jurisdictions would be restricted to a lower levy. And then we calculate, so that's what the effect of not, so if we didn't pass this bill, of all the jurisdictions we could measure, they'd be about $4 million over their new levy limit. So presumably they would want to levy what they levied last year. With this bill, they would get that levy authority restored, and they would be able to continue to levy what they levied last year. So it's not a tax increase compared to what they levied last year, but if you don't pass this bill, there are some jurisdictions that would be forced to reduce their levies because their levy limit would get lower, and that's what the revenue estimate reflects. They get to levy back to where they were last year because property taxes are higher. There are some increases in property tax refunds and reductions in income tax because of bigger deductions on property taxes, on income tax forms.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if I'm getting this right, Mr. Ouellette, what you're saying is that if we do not pass this bill and leave everything as it is right now, levies would be about $4 million less than if we approve this bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, with the best information we could put together with the data we had available, yeah, that's about right.
Right. Are there questions of Mr. Ouellette? Or did Mr. Nord, did you wish to comment?
Madam Chair, Jason Nord from the Department of Revenue. I don't have a whole lot to add other than I think the Mr. Carlson and Mr. Carlson did a good job of explaining the bill. I think the reason why this can't be solved just by changing our interpretation of statutes is because we're dealing with two fundamental terms here. The estimated market value is a known concept and known term. Taxable market value is a known concept and a known term. So when you exclude property from taxation, you can't call it part of taxable market value. And so the exclusion creates a middle ground. And so we really had, I think, to logically make the interpretation that we've made. And obviously with the 112-section bill, it can get quite complicated and have lots of tentacles. So we couldn't just simply make a whole bunch of interpretational decisions and solve all the problems. So that's the bill.
All right. Are there further questions or further discussion on the bill?
Madam Chair.
Representative Markwart.
Are there any further testifiers?
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak in favor of or in opposition to the bill? Oh, concerns.
Madam Chair.
Apparently not. Representative Markwart.
Is there a lobby group for the homeowners here tonight?
Is there a lobby group for the homeowners?
Well, Madam Chair, I know last year when we were taking through this elimination of the homestead credit, we heard from the various city groups and the county groups, but we didn't hear from homeowners last year, and I'm wondering if there's anyone here representing the homeowners out in the audience tonight. Or farmers, are there anyone here representing farmers or small businesses here tonight that would testify for or against this bill? Well, Madam Chair,
Representative Markwart,
you know, someone's got to speak for the homeowner, and that's what we tried to do last year when this bill, I mean, let's face it, we're here tonight because the homestead credit was eliminated and there was a market value exclusion put into place. And despite the warnings from this side and amendments made and so forth, we heard from constantly, well, the city groups aren't happy with this, the county groups aren't happy with this, but nowhere in the committees did we ever hear anyone defending the homeowner. We tried. We tried to get the word out and saying what the net impact would be on farmers and small businesses and so forth, and I'm just wondering if, well, I see now there is somebody, but I mean, I don't think last year, Madam Chair, that anyone went out and asked the homeowner what they thought. If anyone asked them, knocked on their door, and said, you know what, we've got a tax benefit for you that you've had for over four decades, and we'd like to take it away. How would you vote on that, yes or no? And I don't think we asked them that question. And so I see, I think there is someone here to testify for homeowners, possibly.
Mr. Agar would like to testify.
Madam Chair, Paul Agar with the Minnesota Association of Realtors. And, you know, thank you, Representative Markwart, for bringing up the question. You know, we certainly represent realtors here at the Capitol, but we also look out for the interests of homeowners. And most frequently, I'm before this committee advocating for the property tax refund program. That's typically when we get up and advocate for preserving and enhancing that particular program. With respect to the discussion last year on the market value exclusion and the conversion, you know, we were present. I was here listening to the testimony, listening to the discussion. And one of the things that stuck out to us as we listened to the debate and what the potential impact of that change would be was that, yes, the credit, as Representative Lincheski points out, the credit always went out to the homeowner. The reimbursement to the local units of government was often reduced or eliminated in some cases, but the homeowner always got the credit. But the other part of the equation that we listened to when the cities and the counties would testify was what happened when the cities and the counties did not receive their reimbursement. And that's a more complicated story to tell and a more complicated story to understand, because, and the cities and the counties can correct me if I'm wrong, but that left them with very difficult decisions. And the decisions were often in response to reducing or receiving a reduced amount in credit reimbursement or having the credit eliminated altogether was, do we cut services or do we anticipate the cut is coming and levy more than we probably actually would need if what we levied we were actually going to receive? And so given all of these different factors, we didn't take a position on the conversion from the credit to the exclusion. Instead, we continue to focus our efforts in working with you on the means-tested programs like the property tax refund. So it was a difficult issue, and we know you wrestled with it last year, and that's where we ended up on it, Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Mr. Agar. Any questions of the witness? Okay. Any further discussion on the bill? Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess this is for the author of the bill. Representative Davids, why didn't you just eliminate the exclusion and bring back the homestead credit?
Representative Davids.
I didn't want to.
Madam Chair, you know, no one asked the homeowners last year, and when I was out and about, folks were not, you know, very happy about it, and it hit them pretty hard, and we know the results. I mean, it's not like you can just wish this thing away. I mean, the results came down, and, you know, when all was said and done, you know, the cities levied, you know, the cities set their property tax levy, and the counties set their property tax levy, and the schools set their property tax levy, and the townships and all the special districts, they set their property tax levies. And from last year to this year, the increase in their property taxes that we pay was an increase of only about $80 million net, if you take the tax increment, which went down, about $80 million. Which total property tax increase was less than 1% statewide. So, you know, I know in the past, you know, there's been blame on cities and counties raising, but, you know, this year, you can't say that. $80 million out of over $8 billion total. It was less than a 1% levy increase. And yet, what people paid around the state was an increase of $370 million. And, in fact, Mr. Hines just gave a report the other day in taxes. I don't know if everyone saw that. But about $260 million of the $370 million was directly related to the elimination of the homestead credit. Directly. No ifs, ands, or buts. And, you know, we can go over why that is. But because you no longer had, over a biennium, $538 million going into the system, cities and counties had to make that up. And even if you kept your levy the same, even if you kept the levy the same as the year before, whatever you lost in the homestead credit, you had to raise back. Or that was the net impact on the property taxpayer. And, you know, you wonder, well, how did that shift on to, like, businesses and farms? Well, let's take an example here. Let's say the five of us each have a home and our tax capacity is $20. Just $20. Let's use it. So the total tax capacity is $100. And this city, county, everyone needs a total of $100 to operate. So they're going to charge 100% levy against that $100 tax capacity to get your $100. All right, now with the market value exclusion, let's say it went down 10%. Didn't go down quite, well, depending on what community, but statewide it went down about 7%. But let's use 10% just as an example. So now our total value, instead of 100, is $90. $90. And let's say these communities, despite inflation, despite growth, despite improvements they have to make, we're going to hold the levy exactly the same as last year, which many did. So we need that $100 again. But now, instead of 100 tax capacity, the tax capacity is 90. So now the rate is 111%. So businesses now, instead of 100, they're going to get 111% on that value. farms, 111%. Now, homeowners, some of the market value exclusion masked it for some. Some they came out all right, but they still got hit with that 111, so the exclusion might not have been enough, and that's where you saw $71 million of increase on the very homeowners we were given the exclusion to. But it hit businesses by $133 million, the very same people, you know, the job creators. Ag was $52 million. That's huge. And most of that directly impacted on because of the elimination of the homestead credit. Rural members, because we have lower valued homes in rural Minnesota, about 60% of the market value homestead credit went to rural communities. And that's why when you look at the information put out by House Research, rural Minnesota of that $370 million saw 64% of the increase. 64%. And if you slice that a little further, if you look at homeowners, just homes, the increase on a home in rural Minnesota was almost 8 times higher than the metro area. A business was 3 times. It really hit rural Minnesota hard. And so, I mean, I'm very concerned about this. And, you know, the exclusion just doesn't do it. I mean, it did pad it for a lot, but it really spread it out and about. And I still think the only thing we really should have done with this is totally eliminated. And, you know, with this bill, as you saw, not only, you know, I mean, a yes vote on this bill not only does not restore the homestead credit, which caused this mess in the first place, but it raises property taxes by $4 million. Which means we just, there's just an increase of $370 million in property taxes, and now you're going to say yes to a bill that's going to raise taxes $4 million more. That is moving in the wrong direction. I think you send this back, I mean, you fix the whole thing, you bring this back. We need a lot more discussion. You know, last year there was not the discussion on this, and that's why we wind up in a situation like we are tonight. It was rushed through to save $538 million. So, I'd like to see what the author thinks of why he doesn't want to restore the homestead credit. Yes, I understand cities and counties and some of those might have affected how they budgeted, anticipated, especially when we had a lot of cuts towards the end. But remember that we've had this for 40-some years, and the first 30-some years of this program was only reduced twice. And there's mention that 8 of the last 10 years it's been cut, but 84% of the cities until the last 2 years were never cut. In fact, the only reason the other 100-some were cut is because those were the cities, when we were getting into deficits, that really didn't have local government aid or much. So to try to even things off as the cuts in LGA, we looked, well, what can we take from these cities that don't have local government aid? Well, we took the homestead credit. But rural Minnesota cities, we never got cut at all in homestead credit the last couple years. And then remember that schools were never cut. Schools were never cut a dime, and homeowners were never cut a dime. So that bill last year was significant departure from what we've had in the past, because it cut homeowners and it cut schools, which we had never done before. And this was permanent. None of the other cuts, well, the cuts to the wealthier cities, those were, but everything else that happened the last 2 years were one-time type of things. So, members, I would ask for a strong no vote. Like I said, not only does this not fix the problem, doesn't restore the homestead credit, but it moves us in the wrong direction by raising property taxes into the next year.
Yes, Representative Davids, final comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, under Rule 6.903 of House Rules, one member cannot question another member's motives, first of all, or intentions, I believe that rule says, first of all. Second of all, this is a technical fix bill, is what this is. What happened was the department didn't notify anyone, and correct me if I'm wrong, that this was going to happen. The intention of the legislation last year was not to do the things that it did here. So if you want to vote against this bill and shorten your cities and counties up by $4 million, that's up to you. That was never my intention to do that. So, Madam Chair and members, I'd appreciate a strong yes vote on this bill.
Is there further discussion on the bill? Okay, seeing none then, the chair renews her motion that House file.
Madam Chair, I'd like to call a roll call, please.
Roll call's been requested. The CLA will take the roll.
Wow.
But the chair will renew her motion that House file 2072, as amended, be recommended to pass, and this bill will go on to Ways and Means Committee. Oh, taxes first. Okay, taxes.
No. And, Madam Chair, before you vote, I've got to look up my House rule number, and that might not be exactly the right one, but we'll find it.
Thank you.
Chair Runbeck?
Yes.
Representative Crawford?
Yes.
Representative Marquardt?
No.
Representative Barrett?
Yes.
Representative Benson?
No.
Representative Doubt?
Yes.
Representative Detmer?
Yes.
Representative Dietrich?
No.
Representative Coonan?
Yes.
Representative Lemire? Representative Lemire is excused. Representative Lincheski?
No.
Representative Loeffler?
No.
Representative Mahoney?
No.
Representative McDonald?
Yes.
Representative Peterson?
Yes.
Representative Wardlow?
Yes.
There being nine ayes and six nays, the motion does prevail. Oh, Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Just to the chairman, if there is something that I said that directed to your intent, I apologize. I don't know for sure what that was, but I consider the chair a very good friend. In fact, we have wind up in the workout room at the Kelly Inn every once in a while and so forth. But if there was something I said that I apologize for that. I'm not aware of what that was, but I
Madam
will
Chair,
apologize.
Representative Davids.
Thank you to that point, and I've always considered Representative Marquardt a gentleman. But when you say, why are you doing this, that is questioning a motive. And according to House rules, that's not appropriate. But I still love
Representative Marquardt.
Miss Madam Chair, I think it was more rhetorical, but I understand that. Very good. Thank you.
Very good. I think we've finished the business for today, and we will I will see you again on Wednesday morning, 8:15. Meeting's adjourned.